Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, March 11th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Orange County's source of talk, alternative music, and anteater sports. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org, available via podcast on the Stitcher app, and more information about the show and about local literary events is available on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with novelist Elisa Albert. But first up, Matt Summel. Matt is a graduate of our very own esteemed UC Irvine's MFA program in writing, and his short fiction has appeared in the Paris Review, Esquire, Electric Literature, Noon, McSweeney's, One Story, and elsewhere. We're here to talk about his first collection, Making Nice, published by Henry Holt & Company. Matt, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, and happy to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Or should I say welcome home?
Thank you.
Are you in New York right now?
I am. I am sitting in my agent's lovely apartment right across from a major construction site.
Ah.
So if you hear some weird noises in the background, that would be that.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. We had dogs last time. So.
Oh, dogs. Okay. Well, dogs are preferable. But.
And let's start by having you talk about your book. Can you introduce it to listeners?
Oh, gosh. That's tough. You know, it is a collection of linked stories, all with the same narrator, Albie, who is struggling with grief after losing his mother and, you know, with the idea that bad decisions make for good stories. Albie sort of indulges in a lot of those baser impulses. And, you know, it's I wrote them all the stories at Irvine. And so they sort of jump around in chronology and everything, but there is an overall narrative arc, which is, you know, trying to find a new way to survive.
Yeah, I was interested when I looked back and saw that it was called a collection, because in my mind I was just thinking of it as a novel, and that worked for me, too.
Yeah, you know, that's actually like a marketing thing. It's really interesting to see this, you know, on this side of it. I wrote them as stories. And then they weren't sure what to call it. They were like, well, of course, they want to call it a novel because novels sell better, apparently. And I wasn't necessarily comfortable with that. You know, we were like, well, then you sort of get dinged and beat up in the reviews because it's not a traditional novel. And so what we did was we decided to call it nothing at all. Like, if you look at the cover, it doesn't say novel, it doesn't say stories, and we just sort of left that for people to make up for themselves.
Oh, that's interesting. And some of them were published in the places I mentioned before, right? Like the Paris Review and...
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, because I did, I wrote them. This thing took me like 10 years probably or 9 years. And you know, and I wrote them over, you know, some of them took me 7 of those years. But I wrote them individually, but it was all the same. Again, it was the same narrator. And so once I would do that, I would send them out, you know. And there's this Ann Beattie quote, which... you know, is more about writing stories and what that process is like, where it's like crossing a stream. Now I'm on this rock. Now I'm on this rock. Now I'm on this rock. And for me, like, I could sort of see that as my career, too, like publishing. It was like, okay, well, now I'm in like, you know, Fault Line, you know, UC Irvine's journal. And then it was like, okay, well, now I'm in some zine called Saltgrass, and now I'm in the Brooklyn Review, and now I'm in Electric Literature. And, you know, it was just sort of like, it sort of kept me going. It kind of motivated me to publish these stories in different literary journals.
Mm. And as you're working at UC Irvine, well, in your acknowledgments, you thanked people from, I think, colleagues and professors from UC Irvine who encouraged you to, quote unquote, follow your weird. Can you talk about that?
I believe that was a Jim Shepherd quote. You know, over the years, I think, I had so many great teachers, and it's such a great program there. And, I mean, Michelle Latiolet, of course, and Jeffrey Wolfe, Mark Richard, and Christine Scott, and Amy Bender, and Miley Malloy. I just was exposed to so many great writers and teachers. And I know that MFA programs sort of get this bad rep as homogenizing or something. You know, and there's this new collection out, I guess, or MFA versus NYC, you know, and it sort of like dings the MFA programs a little bit, I think. But that wasn't my experience at Irvine. And I think Irvine sort of has this interesting approach, which is, to hold the story to the standard of the best thing in it. And so it almost says, okay, so where is it most engaging? And then do more of that. And I think that has a way of, like, encouraging you to follow your own weird and not do the very specific conventional, you know, just minimalism or something like that. And it helped me really develop my voice.
And there was some other writing advice I've heard you talk about elsewhere, which involved the material, because you said something about writing about nail salons, and then that mentor said, you know, don't do that, but look for something with more heart, or I forget what was lacking.
Maybe it was gravity or you know, but it was Jeffrey Wolfe who said that, you know, that writing is not stand-up. It has to be more than that. And then Mark Richard came along as a visiting professor there, and he said, you know, Matt, you got to make them laugh and break their bleeping hearts, you know, and if you do those two things, you're doing pretty good. So that became the goal, you know. It's like and I think in the beginning I was just trying to be funny and write something, you know, comical. And then I realized, you know, you have to use what hurts. There has to be some sort of seriousness to the project, because otherwise it gets dismissed. So, after my mother got sick is when I started to look at that and use that.
And going back to the humor part, because let's talk for a little bit about writing humor, because your work is funny, even though it does have the gravity. And so
thank you.
At what point does that humor come out? Does that come so naturally to you that it's there in the first draft, or how do you work with that?
I think so. I mean, I have such a dark gallows sense of humor. It's really a survival technique. It's a coping mechanism. If I'm not laughing and making really inappropriate jokes, I'm crying, you know? So, for me anyway, that sort of comes natural, and I think it's always there. I'm actually surprised often that people are like, shocked by some of these jokes. I'm like, I guess not everybody has this shares this sense of humor. I don't know this is wildly inappropriate. I'm like, wildly inappropriate. You know, where I'm from on Long Island, this is tame. But it's always been there, and it's something I've, you know, it's really hard to be funny on the page, and I'm glad that people are actually, you know, sort of responding to my attempts at that.
Okay, so you brought up this wildly inappropriate idea.
And
I was kind of curious, because there were, for me, some moments, you know, and did that come up in the editorial process? Did anyone question your decisions, or did you have to dial any of it back, or did they just say, you know, go for it?
No, I mean, I think I did not have to, no one asked me to dial anything back at all. I think, if anything, it was sort of a self-governing thing. And you know, there are things where even I look at them now and I guess, yeah, there are some wildly inappropriate lines in there. gosh, I think there's one about, Eric Clapton's kid. And I look at that and I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe that I allowed my narrator, Albie, to say something so horrific and so horrendous. And it's, you know, it's not funny or anything like that. It's just almost mean, and what rights does he have to this material? But you know, no one sort of came at me and they were, and asked me to take that out, or you know, pull it back here or pull it back there. They just sort of trusted my judgment, and you know, sometimes I scratch my head going, should they have let me trust my judgment? I don't know. You know, there was no editing of that kind of stuff.
I'm talking to Matt Summel. His book is Making Nice. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Now, Matt, if possible, to give listeners a flavor for your writing, I'd love to have you read. Is that possible?
It's possible. I'm going to be editing on the fly, because this language is, there's a lot of bad language in the book. And I'm not really, I'll do my best here to to edit. So if you hear a pause, an awkward pause, it's because I am skipping a word.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay. Should I go ahead?
Yes, please.
Okay. What I did was mix a cup of cat food with a quarter cup of applesauce, a tongue smooth dissolved tablet ground to powder, a hard-boiled egg and water until it was the approximate consistency of cooked oatmeal. I did that because that's what it said to do online. It also said online to cut the end of a straw to make a small scoop, to feed it every 14 to 20 minutes from sunrise to sunset. You should never put liquids directly into its mouth or it could drown, to keep it warm, and that despite your best efforts, 90 to 95% will die. Good luck. With luck like that, I didn't name him at first. I didn't think I could stand losing another thing with a name. When he lasted a week, I called him Gary. Gary was, for the most part, at least to start off with, almost transparent. He looked like a dog's heart with a bird's head stuck on, a blob with a beak. And one time, when I was leaning in real close to better see the veins pumping blood under his skin, he woke up and bit me on the nose and started chirping like crazy. I shushed him and fed him till he stopped chirping like crazy and closed his eyes and went back to sleep. Then I just watched him breathe for a while, making sure he wasn't dead. One morning, when I was making sure he wasn't dead, there was a knock on my bedroom door, and my father popped his toupee head in. "Made your breakfast," he said. "Steak and eggs." "We don't have steak," I said, "or eggs, so I know you're lying." "I did," he insisted, but really he didn't, because what he'd actually made me was a chicken and cheese hot pocket that he thought was a steak and egg hot pocket, because for some reason he'd thrown out the boxes and hot pockets all looked the same. None of which matters. What matters is that when my losing his mind, father saw Gary set up on my desk, he told me I was losing mine. Maybe I was. By this point, I'd abandoned the laundry lint and cereal bowl nest because the lint was getting stuck in Gary's pin feathers, instead opting for crumpled hand towels and a small Easter basket suspended with string from the handle of a large Easter basket. For decor and scent's sake, I'd paper-clamped on some pine cones and twigs and fastened a large oak leaf over the whole thing to shade them from the lamp. Finally, I bought a big wooden G from the local arts and crafts store and painted it the same green as a horsefly eye, then glued it to the handle of the big basket. "What are you?" my father asked me, the sun coming through the window, lighting half his face. "Crazy now?" If I could go back, I'd answer differently. I'd lie that I was fine or make a joke or tell him the truth, that I was just trying to get through it, that I was having a hard time, that, and I know how hollow and sentimental this sounds, how lame. I missed my mother in a way that felt anaerobic. I couldn't get my air back. At one point, I literally stuck my head out the car window and opened my mouth to force it in. "What do you mean now?" I said. It fell flat in front of us like a stupid fact, and there was nothing left for him to do but hobble over to get a better look. And after he got a better look, he turned a better look at me, and then he better looked at Gary's setup again. "Listen," I said, "he's helpless and he needs me, and I got a thing in my heart for helpless things that need me, okay? So I'm going to be here for him until he dies or grows into a falcon that flies around the neighborhood all day, eating raccoons and dogs and little toddlers before he flies back to my farm and takes turds. I already ordered the glove, dude, online, because Gary here is going to terrorize all of Suffolk County, hunting mammals and raping seagulls." Figure I should stop there.
Thank you. That was Matt Summel reading from his latest book, Making Nice. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And yes, not to give any spoilers, but I mean, Gary's a great... I loved Gary.
Thank you.
So sometimes when a story is closer to the author... And perhaps you've seen this kind of thing too, but you read a scene or a small detail and it lands on you with the feeling, oh, I bet that really happened. And I'm sure the feeling isn't even right. And I have to say, this doesn't happen in your book, but do you know what I'm talking about? And how do you avoid having details stick out like that?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, look, there are parts of this book that are really close. And this is a question that I get all the time where people are like, you know, how autobiographical is this? And it's like, gosh, I don't even know how to answer that question. I mean, what are you, 56% in this story, 33% in that one? You know, I don't know how to calculate that. That said, you know, this book is in places very emotionally expensive for me. And, you know, sort of what we were talking about earlier with Jeffrey Wolfe, sort of saying, use the good luck of bad luck, use what hurts. I mean, I have done that, and I have taken, like, you know, the wreck of my life in places and tried to make use of that. So I don't know. It's a really interesting question. I didn't really take any aim or make any effort to avoid that necessarily, but I'm sort of having to deal with it now.
Can you go on? Like, what do you mean that you're dealing with it now?
I'm just dealing with it now in terms of, like, okay, there's some fallout, right? Like, so I'm getting these questions. I was just on Entertainment Weekly's radio show on Sirius XM the other day, and they were, like, asking me very specific questions, like, did you save a bird in your driveway? And, you know, and I was like, yes, I did. Did you do this? And did you do that? And, you know, and you go, and you're, it's like, it's hard to sort of navigate that. And then I had a friend who was like, hey, is this me in the book? Am I, why are you writing me like about, writing about me like that? And I'm like, it's not you. And I suppose this is a very, you know, it's a very common thing. I think anybody who uses, or takes anything from quote unquote real life, and makes use of that for their work, has to deal with this kind of thing. And I think, you know, no matter what you take from real life, you know, it is a selection that you're making, right? You're selecting things to include, which means you're also selecting things not to include. So it is not the whole truth. It is a distortion of the truth, which I believe makes that fiction.
Yeah, no, I want to be clear that I wasn't asking you how much of it was real. I just realized that, you know, some of it was, and I don't frankly care what was and what wasn't. But
right.
It was not the case that there were any details that stuck out. And sometimes when you're reading something, you'll say, oh, that meal, I bet that author had that meal. And it's hard to say why these details, like, don't feel genuine. But so I'm just trying to learn from you, like, how you curate your details so that that doesn't happen.
I have no idea, really. I just sort of use what I personally would find interesting. I mean, I hardly consider my audience, which is to say, I just, you know, like, I'm sort of saying, well, is this interesting to me? Is this important to me in my life? Do I find this detail, like, compelling or heartbreaking or very concrete and specific? And does it lend my fiction a kind of, you know, realism, you know, and then I make use of it. And then if it feels right to me, it's like, there's not much that's contrived here. Like, if it feels correct to me, it's like feeling my way around in the dark, and I sort of go on that. I don't know if that helps. I don't know if that's helpful at all. It's just sort of my blundering way of trying to explain my process.
Yeah, no, it sounds like the way you do it is trusting your gut, and that is good advice.
There's a much simpler way of saying it. Yes, I trust my gut.
Changing direction a little bit, you mentioned you're in your agent's apartment.
Yes, I am.
I like to ask.
And I was going to say, and there are probably some people in the other room you'd much rather talk to. I mean, there's a lunch here today, and I think it's going to be like Nathan Englander and Robbie Alameddine and a bunch of, you know, much more established and successful writers than me filling up in the other room. So those are the people you might hear in the background.
Well, say hello for us. But I like to ask debut authors how they got their agent. So could you tell us that story of how you hooked up with your agent?
I got so lucky. I mean, I'm tremendously fortunate. it was a long process. Again, it was sort of one publication after another. You know, Mark Richard, when he was the visiting writer there, he really liked one of my stories, and he wanted to send it out for me. And he was like, you know, Matt, my process was I sent it off to Harper's. I got published in Harper's. You know, you start at the top. You don't have to do much climbing. And I was like, oh, great, I want to do that. And so Mark sent out my story to Harper's, and it just got me rejected that much quicker. You know, it was just, nope, not for us, thank you. And so my process was really different, and it was, again, like smaller publications to a slightly, you know, less smaller publication, you know, and then just climbing my way up for a decade. And eventually I got to a place, once I was in the Paris Review, I got a call from Gordon Lish, actually, for the listeners, if they don't know, Gordon Lish was like Raymond Carver's editor, and I guess he read a story of mine in Electric Literature that he liked, and I'm not sure if he saw me in the Paris Review or what, but, you know, you reach that level, it was like just knocking on the same doors for years, and then finally you get let in, and, you know, you get a certain literary credibility, I guess, and once Gordon Lish had contacted me, I had some friends say, well, you better watch out for Gordon Lish. He's, you know, he has this reputation, and maybe it's time to get some kind of representation for yourself. And so we started sending out a small section of the book to different agents. You know, I just sort of reached out to people and said, how about this person? How about this person? How about this person? And I sort of sent it out to maybe five agents and just waited to hear back. And then I met with Gordon Lish, and the guy was nothing but nice to me and wanted nothing from me and really had some kind things to say about the work. So I got lucky. I had actually gotten a great agent by the name of P.J. Marks interested, P.J. Mark, and I love this guy. And we were talking a lot about the work and everything else and sort of having a dialogue about it. And that is when a friend of mine has been a big champion of my work from the beginning, Andy Hunter, who started Electric Literature, said, hold on, before you end up, you know, signing anything or officially, you know, going with PJ, let me make a phone call. And he called a friend of his who happens to be Nicole Araji. And he said, not only is she one of my favorite people in publishing, she's one of my favorite people. And she may not want to take any short story writers, but let me try. And he made a phone call to her for me. And I guess she read my work that morning and invited me to come out to New York to sit down and meet with her. And that was that.
Wow. I'm talking to Matt Summel. His book is Making Nice. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And Matt, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I just want to ask if you have any favorite writing advice you can share with listeners.
Well, I always, my fallback is to sort of just parrot what I learned at Irvine, and that would be, what Mark Richard told me, which was, you know, just make them laugh and break their hearts. And if you can do those two things, you're doing well. And then there are other things I've stumbled on across the way, you know, whether that's writing could be revenge against your bullies or follow your weird or to use the good luck of bad luck, to use what hurts. I mean, there's a list. But, the one that was, I think, that resonated with me most was make them laugh and break their hearts.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Summel, author of Making Nice. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Author Elisa Albert will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with author Matt Summel. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Elisa Albert. Elisa is the author of the novel The Book of Dahlia and How This Night is Different, A Book of Stories, as well as the editor of the anthology Freud's Blind Spot. Her stories and essays have appeared in such publications as Tin House, Commentary, Salon, The Rumpus, Gulf Coast, and on NPR. She received her MFA from Columbia University, where she currently teaches as an adjunct assistant professor of creative writing. Her latest book is the novel After Birth, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I am so happy she is here to talk about it. Hi there, Elisa.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. We find that no one introduces a book better than its author. Would you introduce this novel to us?
Sure. It's the story of 3 months in the life of a woman named Ari who has a one-year-old baby and had a really hard birth, unexpected, traumatic surgical birth. She can't quite get over, and she's sort of spinning out even a year later. She lives in a kind of dystopian upstate New York town, a post-industrial kind of wreck of a town, and she's having a hard time making friends, and she feels cut off and isolated and kind of desperate and lost.
This book explores intimately this topic that's you know, so important and also ubiquitous. And I think it's odd that it hasn't really been covered much, at least not in literary fiction. Can you talk about why you think that literary takes on the first year of motherhood are scarce?
Well, for one, I think that a lot of people who can speak to this are having kind of an overwhelming time within it. So it's hard to make anything artistically when you're sort of subsumed by the realities of early motherhood. So that's one. And then I think what happens when people kind of get out of it, when enough time passes, their children grow up, there's this really useful amnesia where it's like, oh, yeah, that was really hard. But anyway, onward. I think that's common. I think that's really beneficial because, you know, nobody wants to stay in that kind of besieged place forever. And then the last thing I think is that it's, you know, it's a woman thing. So who cares, kind of.
Yikes, but yes. and when I was reading your book, I like to read it without reading the blurbs or anything. And then about a third of the way in, I thought, you know, this reminds me of Jenny Offal. And then I turned it over and I saw that she, of course, had something positive to say about the book. And I'm wondering what authors you turn to or who you like to read. And
I love Jenny's book. I read it in one sitting and just adored it. I was sort of raised on Laurie Moore and Philip Roth, who are strange bedfellows, but I sort of see myself as having been forged like somewhere in between those two. I love Shalom Auslander. I mean, it's nice to have blurbs from people you actually really love to read. Kind of makes the whole endeavor not a waste of time. I love dark humor. I love writers who don't shy away from, going there, wherever there is.
An important character in the book is Mina, the former member of a girl rock band who moves to town and is 9 months mm-hmm. pregnant. Could you talk about the inspiration for that character?
Yeah, well, I like Ari, had moved to upstate New York, to Albany, actually, with a newborn, and was just very, very in need of female friendship, any kind of friendship, but female friendship especially, because I don't have a sister, I'm not very close with my mother, my family's really far away, and this like deep need rose to the surface, and I hadn't really known it was there, but it was very much there. And that's how I began to kind of make sense of the whole experience of having given birth and raising a tiny child and, this whole kind of like, I call it like the female war experience because it's kind of what it is, just in the trenches. And I set about like looking to build myself a community. So I learned a lot about myself and I wanted to give this character, you know, what I wanted, kind of. It was like wishful, you know. Who's a woman who could appear on my block, you know, and we could get through this together and it would all be great. So, you know, I mean, as with any fiction for me, it's kind of like a weird Frankenstein hybrid of, you know, people I know, people I wish I knew, people I hope to know, situations I've experienced, blown up 100 times, you know, that kind of funhouse mirror of fiction where, you know, it was like inspired by friendships I was forging, but it doesn't actually faithfully reflect any particular reality.
We're talking to novelist Elisa Albert. Her new novel is After Birth. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Elisa, I was mulling over some of the things you mentioned earlier. So you talked about selective amnesia being part of the factor of this material not being common in literary fiction. Mm-hmm. And also not turning away from stuff that is hard or complicated or dark. So when you do you journal, or how do you hold on to these things long enough to get where you get with them?
Yeah, I totally journal. I go back and forth between calling it a journal and a notebook. I can't quite make up my mind, like which I prefer. I don't know why it matters, but I always have a Moleskine going. Usually it takes about a year to fill one. That's kind of been my pattern. I'm not religious about it. It's not like a daily thing. It's just kind of like it's always with me, and when I need it, I can grab it. So it was hard with Ari, with this character, because she's in this really specific place. It's intense and dark, and I myself wasn't in that place for most of the writing of the book. You know, I might have been there when it started, but I, you know, quickly evolved to a different place, and the character didn't. So to like force myself to stay in that place with her for longer than maybe I would have liked to was really instructive and kind of a good exercise, or maybe just masochistic. I don't know, depending on your perspective.
That's really interesting. And I think it's funny because, if I'm not mistaken, I think Jenny Offal shares a dislike of the word journaling.
Yeah. Yeah. But it sounds like a little too, it sounds a little more touchy-feely than what it actually is. You know, it like, it's not automatic writing. It's not, you know, it's not a kind of like a woo-woo exercise. It's just kind of like, got to write things down on a regular basis, you know?
Right. Elisa, would you read to us from your book at this point?
Sure.
Great.
Let me just cross the room and get it. Here it is. Okay, here's a little section. The baby's first birthday. Surgery day, I point out, because I have trouble calling it birth. Anniversary of the great failure. Ari, don't. Can't handle a party, none of that circus stuff. Baby doesn't know the difference. We give him his first taste of ice cream after dinner, sing a song, blow out a candle on his behalf, clap, kiss. We forget to take pictures. The joyful chocolate-faced baby, lone candle, flurry of my desperate attempts at good cheer. Will comes over with a bottle of good scotch. We made it, babe, Paul says, toasting. Who exactly does he imagine as having made it? And to where? All we've done is get used to it. Clink. I'm surrounded by sweet males. There is that. Okay, so I'm going to skip the part where she's going into the horrible birth. In the shocking days that followed, I saw the requisite awfulness. The baby harmed, the baby hurt, the baby suffering, the baby hurled to the ground, the baby's head crushed against the wall. Ongoing fever dream, in the grip of a kind of black magic for which I was entirely unprepared, woke in a sweat from intermittent sleep to find him still, oh, thank God, breathing. He's breathing, okay, he's breathing, okay, he's breathing, okay, 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 okay. I wandered too near the white-hot root of things, flummoxed, big now to a possibility of loss so extreme I could barely breathe myself. The baby book said nothing about this. Days became nights, became days, became nights. The baby book said nothing. I held him tight, held him close, would not let go. The harm that could come to him, the consequence of just one misstep, unthinkable, unbearable. What now? What next? I'll take him, babe, Paul would say. Give him to me. Try and get some rest. My infected incision oozed, tight, phony grin of a sadistic monster, the necessary course of antibiotics. I had died, was dead, only a ghost, not fully gone. Watch him breathe. Is he breathing? Hold him close. Move slow. Wrap yourself around him. Easy, easy, don't hurt him. Careful. Is he alive? The world so hideously perilous, and the baby a raw egg, only of its kind.
Thank you. That was novelist Elisa Albert, reading from her new novel, After Birth. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Now, this characteristic of your writing is to combine this voice, this strong voice, with this dark humor. And so can you talk about the humor in your writing? Does it come out in the first draft, or how does it appear there?
Yeah, you know, it's a coping mechanism, I think, is what it comes down to. It's the only way I know of to sort of get at the dark stuff that we don't want to look away from is to simultaneously note the absurdity and the silliness and the, you know, ultimate, you know, inconsequentiality of all of our, you know, little human struggles. It's like, if we're going to like remain in such tight close up on like such a raw moment for a character, then we can't not at the same time like pull all the way back and have it be kind of absurd, you know? I think that's just like the way my brain is wired.
And so when you were working on the book, what did revisions look like? Did you go all the way through a draft and then...
Oh, no. I'm so not one of those. I'm always like this kind of two steps forward, one step back writer, where I'm just like circling it. Where like some days, like I might just like go back to the beginning and tweak sentences for, you know, 20 pages and then write, you know, three sentences. The forward motion happens kind of unpredictably. Like I'm kind of like biding my time until I have enough like force behind me somehow, enough momentum to push forward. But otherwise I'm just like walking in circles in what I've already done.
And so you what you're saying is that you don't outline?
I don't. I mean, I've tried now and again, just because there are desperate moments where it seems like you just have to, because how else are you going to move forward? So I've tried in my way to like build in structural conceits, or, you know, just make lists for myself, or like, let's just take stock of where we are and where we need to go. But I don't like know what's going to happen. You know, it's like I start a book with like a broad general idea of like what it's about, and then it's kind of like an improv exercise, you know. Then it's just kind of like, okay, like, you know, girl's dying of a brain tumor and she's a total screw up, go. And I don't know where it's going to go, but if I kind of like stay in it in the right way and don't lose the thread of like what I'm trying to do, then hopefully. But yeah, it's not the greatest way to work, because you're lost a lot of the time. But I think that lostness also confers like a authenticity, dare I say authenticity, to writing, because it's a process of discovery, et cetera.
And at what point did you know how the book would end?
I don't know. I can't say. I did have the last scene. I like probably halfway through I hit on that last scene where Ari is in the, you know, the health food store, and she, you know, she like kind of judges and hates all these other women all throughout the novel, all from her past, and women are just this like ongoing disappointment to her. And I knew that she was going to, you know, this minor character from the beginning, a colleague of her husband's who like wears too much makeup and punishing heels, and so she feels like she can't be friends with her just because of those things, that woman was going to appear and sort of have a moment of softness where Ari was suddenly going to be like, oh, like you have something to offer me. You're something else. Like I was wrong. I knew that. And then that's a comfort. That's a huge comfort. I find that with stories and with novels both, is that like at some point I will hit upon like the closing moment, and then I'm like, okay, like there's all this blank space in between the, you know, the first two thirds and the last moment, but the last moment is there. It's like a lighthouse, and I can, I'm not going to totally lose my way.
We're talking to novelist Elisa Albert. Her new novel is After Birth. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And one last question about outlining. After you've finished a draft or two, or and you have completed it, do you find it useful at that point to go back and outline, or just never?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's crucial, especially with a novel like this that's kind of like nonlinear and not very like plotted. I actually, with this one, it was short enough. Somebody suggested, it was the writer Nick Flynn, whose work I love, and who also, his books are nonlinear and not plotted, his prose, I should say. And he suggested, like, laying it out on the floor. So the book is composed of all these little sections with space breaks in between, and I had it all printed out, and each little section got its own little pile, and I laid it out on the floor, and I spent, like, 2-3 days crawling around and organizing. There are 3 sections to the novel, November, December, January, so I did one at a time, actually. So November was all over the floor, and I kind of figured out exactly how to fit it together, and then December, January. So that was a neat thing to do. I think it would be too overwhelming with a longer book, but it worked nicely for this one. And it was kind of had that a great physical aspect to it that, you know, that you don't get very often when you're writing.
Hmm. And we learn as a reader about Ari through her relationships and her actions with her family and her friends. But I was thinking about it, and if I remember correctly, I mean, you have a lot of story about her maternal grandmother in particular, mm-hmm. but I don't mm-hmm. recall her relationship with her paternal grandparents. And obviously, right. one has to draw the line somewhere, but I'm curious whether that was intentional or they weren't important enough to her character, or could you talk about, you know, where one draws that line of...
Yeah, that's such a good question. I trained as a childbirth doula, like, after I finished this book, because I was kind of still obsessed and needed more of an outlet. And when we introduced ourselves at doula training, we were asked to introduce ourselves and our maternal line as far back as we knew it, because, as it was explained, females are born with all of our eggs. So, you know, the egg that would become my son existed in my body when I was in my mother's body. And the egg that would become me existed in her body when she was in her mother's body, like, all the way back to, like, the start of time. And that was pretty mind-blowing. And I knew that women were born with, you know, X many eggs and that was it. But I had never really thought about how that connected women in the maternal line, like, back to, you know, Eve. And I loved that, and I wanted Ari to sort of be speaking from within the maternal line, and, like, this really particularly damaged maternal line that, you know, you can't kind of make a happy story out of. It's just legacy of really incredible damage. And I wanted it to be kind of claustrophobic within that. So, yeah.
That's interesting, because, I mean, the father is there, but he's not, he feels, you know, less central. And it's just interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, it's like the men are, you know, in this book, men are not harmful. They're not the enemy, but they're a little bit inconsequential, you know? Like, their contribution is, like, finite and kind of not as interesting to me, which is an interesting exercise just for this particular book, just to sort of, like, really close up on the women.
What has the reception been like from male readers? Like, are they...
Well, I guess I don't hear from the ones who aren't receptive. I hear from mostly the receptive ones. I have had a couple people sort of, some jokingly, some not so jokingly, say, like, oh, well, can a man read this book? And it's, I find that really funny, because I just look at them and I say, like, well, somebody gave birth to you, right? And they kind of look startled and they say, like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, I guess. I never thought of it that way. And I'm kind of like, really? You never thought of, like, you have a mother. Everybody had to be given birth to. So everybody's been through this transformation at least once. You know, birth and death are pretty universal until we've managed to engineer artificial gestation, which probably isn't too far off, but that's another story entirely.
We're talking to novelist Elisa Albert. Her new novel is After Birth. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Elisa, we are drawing down on our time, but we have a moment to discuss writing advice, and I'd love to hear what your favorite writing advice is.
I'm just a fan of reading and reading everything and deciding for yourself what's good and not like letting anyone else decide for you what's good. And just finding your own idiosyncratic trail through literature and letting that embolden you and inspire you.
Thank you. And then one last question, because you do have an MFA and you teach in a creative writing program. Do you, for those listeners who are on the fence, you know, should I go the formal studies route or should I do my own thing and just write on my own? Do you have any light to shed on that decision?
I think both. I think, you know, MFAs can be great, the right program, the right time, the right teachers. But it's not like you're going to get an MFA and then not have to go off and do all the writing and thinking by yourself anyway. So it's kind of a false binary, I think. MFAs can be really valuable. I loved mine. It was 2 years of really focused work with a really focused audience of readers who were committed to telling me all about their experience of my work, and that's just priceless. But it's not like a magic bullet, and you know, not everything about it is ideal, and it's not going to get you published, and whatever. But as like one of many things you can do if you're working toward being a writer, I think it can be great.
Elisa, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
That was Elisa Albert. Her new book is After Birth, and it's available now. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.